Welcome back to The Lead, a podcast about content marketing by Copyblogger Media. I'm your host, Jared Morris. So far in our series on content curation, we have broken down why you should curate and the big picture about how to do it, and we've discussed specific tips and strategies for curating links and ideas. In this, the final episode in the series, Damian Farnworth and I tie it all together. Because ultimately, the goal of all of this is to make ourselves and our audiences wiser. Here's how to do it. So how do you curate knowledge? Well, you do what Ryan Holiday instructs subscribers of his monthly reading newsletter to do. Quote, treat your education like the job that it is, unquote. In other words, you read and read actively, and you develop processes for storing what you learn and tying it all together when you need to. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's step back and define what it is we're doing. So, Damian, what is knowledge anyway?
Thanks for giving me the hard part. Knowledge, I think first and foremost, when we hear the word knowledge, we think of information, we think of facts, we think of, you know, history books, we think of, you know, coding languages, how to do coding languages, that sort of thing. But that's really just a fraction of what true knowledge actually is, because, you know, what we want to get from, we want to get from knowledge to actually wisdom. So, but you can also accumulate knowledge, like, you know, through things like experience and then intuition and creativity. There's, you know, a creative knowledge. There's, you know, also an emotional and a social knowledge. And then there's a knowledge about yourself, a sort of self-awareness. And we'll get more into those last three, towards the end of it. But it's this idea of, you know, knowledge is an understanding of your subject matter, and but where, you know, experience and observation come into play. That's how we accumulate that. We've been doing a lot of talking about accumulating that knowledge, not actually kind of defining what it is. But when we think of knowledge, it's that idea of sort of an understanding about a specific subject.
And with what you said, you know, you seem to suggest that the end goal of this is getting to wisdom. What do you see as that difference between knowledge and wisdom?
Here's a great example. So you join a writing critique group, okay? And you will meet people who know everything about how to write and how to write well, but they don't know how to actually do it. Mm-hmm. It's not until experience, not until time. It's not until failure, it's not until trial and error that they actually turn all that knowledge into wisdom, to knowing, you know, because, you know, that's the thing that I run into a lot too when I am mentoring writers is, you know, it's easy for me to tell them what to do, but it takes time, it takes patience to actually get them to do that and to understand that, because what you want that knowledge to become native to your being, so that when you are writing, you know, you can just know that it's sort of like that muscle memory. Like, you know that this is the time in which, you know, a good parallel structure for bullet points would work really well. This is a good time to sort of close it. You have that sort of intuition. That intuition is fed by that knowledge. And then, you know, with a combination of experience and failure and, you know, education and being taught and everything that you've learned. So in that trial and error.
Yeah. Okay. And to kind of tie that back into our purposes here, you know, obviously wisdom is that point where now you can build an audience and develop authority with that. To get there, then, you have to have the knowledge first, right? And so let's talk about this then, Damian. What is so important about not just gaining knowledge, but curating knowledge?
Yeah, curating knowledge, again, it's about, you know, appearing as an expert. For example, you know, nobody's going to listen to, like, someone like Matt Frazier, who's the no-meat athlete, you know, unless he is an authority in exercise and plant-based diets. And nobody's going to listen to Marcus Sheridan unless he is an authority on swimming pools. And nobody, of course, is going to listen to Pam Slim unless she knows early stage entrepreneurship. So it's that idea of appearing as that expert, having that knowledge, and then sharing that knowledge, and which positions you as an expert.
Yeah, and part of appearing like an expert, especially online, is not just doing, right? Though obviously that comes first, but it's also about showing and telling. And this means using the techniques in episodes 2 and 3 of this series to give your audience material that they can read and ideas they can latch onto. And it means both understanding and being able to paint the big picture for your audience, right? Which you get when, you know, which you know how to do from that wisdom that you're hoping to develop from this knowledge that you're gaining. And so, and this is what knowledge curation in our context is all about. And one of the ways that you do that, this idea of being able to paint the big picture, being able to conceptualize for your audience, is by finding hooks. And that is what knowledge curation allows you to do, right, Damien?
Yeah, so for example, like, you know, when I think about knowledge curation as a writer, as a web writer, you know, one of my very first jobs is to, you know, what we do is we research a topic in depth, and we've spoke about this before, but what you're sort of looking for, how can you present this content that makes it unique, that makes it stand out? Because, you know, in the marketplace of products, services, and content, life is a lot like a New York City street where your prospect is, you know, like one of 7 million people stiff-arming thousands of messages competing for their attention. So, and your ideal prospect or reader has her own agenda, and that agenda does not include you, your product, or your idea, or your latest, you know, dumb link article. So you have to earn her attention, right? You have to earn her attention. You need to do that, be drastic. And the best way to do that is with that seductive hook, you know. And here's a great example. For about a year ago, Brian and I did this authority webinar called How to Find the Seductive Hook. And we explained the best way to find that hook is simply to be relentlessly curious about everything, which is what we've been talking about here in the last few podcasts. And then, but someone sort of challenged that notion. Someone asked us if it is better to be a generalist or a specialist. And in order to answer that question, we just had to back up a bit and eat our words. See, we'd just gotten done telling everyone that you needed to be a generalist, but what we should have been saying specifically is that what you need to be is a specialist in your field of expertise.
Okay, so you want to be a specialist in your field of expertise. I mean, literally, like, know everything, or at least most everything there is to know about it, understand the current trends, etc. But you need to be a generalist in terms of your overall knowledge, right? Because this will allow you to find hooks that you can pull your audience in with. You know, again, painting the picture, putting the puzzle together, which is what your audience comes to you for. Did I get that right? Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Because as we, you know, as a specialist, you dominate your own discipline. As a generalist, what that allows you to do, you know, from having that your relentless curiosity, that gives you a lot more landscape in which to find things to make that hook, and you know, to discover that hook gives you a lot more just, you know, inventory for unique ideas and you know, curious ways to sort of bring topics up to the top. And so in order to get to that point, right, so to get that, you know, there's a few things that, you know, habits you have to kind of cultivate. And here are a few habits that I do. Like, for one thing, I try to every year obsess about one subject that I kind of adore, that I'd like to get to know better, that I'd like to get better at. For example, last year I tried to obsess about classical music. This year I'm trying to obsess about chess. And so that just means, you know, reading books, you know, playing chess. Last year I was listening to a lot of different kind of classical music from, you know, the early 1100s, you know, and forward. And but then, so reading books about it, you know, watching videos. And beautiful thing about the internet is you can find almost, you know, anything on anything.
Let me ask you a question about that real quick, because you've already mentioned, you hadn't told me before that chess was your thing that you're doing this year, but it makes sense when you tell me now, because you've mentioned, I think, already a couple times just in this podcast series, you've used chess as an analogy and kind of, you know, kind of compared items that we've been talking about to chess in some way. Do you find when you do that, that you start to just kind of naturally make those links, those connections, and this kind of other thing that you're obsessing about for the year, now it's kind of this new prism through which you can view the thing that you're specializing in and maybe be able to find those hooks then that are applicable to a certain subset of your audience?
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah. I mean, absolutely. That tends to happen. I'm also looking at a chess set, you know, about 10 feet away. So that helps trigger those thoughts. But yeah, you know, you naturally do. And I think what's interesting too, for example, like Benjamin Franklin, he wrote one of the very first pieces of American American literature on chess, and it's called The Morals of Chess. And it's a simple page and a half. But he talks about what learning how to play chess does for an individual. And you read that list, and you can almost sort of just go through a lot of different other sort of exercises, a lot of sort of different other things in life that will teach you sort of the same kind of lessons. So I think there's a lot of overlap in a lot of the things that we do, but you would never have those sort of ideas, or you wouldn't be able to make those associations, those connections, unless you weren't like sort of constantly pouring in that type of information. So that's sort of my point. You know, that's what, you know, sort of our point here is this: good writers, good content creators, good media producers can make great connections, and they can't do that unless they're putting those ideas. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, and modern day context of that too. I mean, for people who watch The Wire and even Orange Is the New Black, chess has been used as a way to explain the drug trade, right? And so again, this is knowledge that's outside of the specific context, subject matter of the show that the writers had, that they're now able to bring in and find that hook, and those become iconic scenes in the show. And it's just, it's again another example of how, you know, you gain this knowledge, and it provides that hook that can explain something to your audience in a way that makes sense to them.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring those two shows up, because another one of my habits, though I don't exercise this one nearly as often as I probably should, is this idea of, you know, running a TV series marathon. You know, the beautiful thing about services like Netflix is that you can sit down and binge on a show like, you know, Orange Is the New Black, and watch an entire, you know, season of shows in one day. I'm proud to say, you know, I'm not ashamed to say that I am the cultural idiot, you know, within Copy Blogger and probably most of the world. But the thing with that is that you would not know. I find that, like, you make that mention about chess and that show, they're making connections there that as a writer, you watch that and you learn how people are just taking knowledge and using wisdom to spin it in a certain way to make a point. And so, you know, even watching those, you're sort of accumulating new information, but you're also watching people, you know, real live writers, right, you know, kind of transform that knowledge into, you know, wisdom to something that's interesting. So yeah, you know, like, you know, binging on a number of, you know, TV series shows, because that's also, you know, you not only accumulate the sort of cultural equity out of that, but you also see how to put a good story together. And another thing is, you know, of course, it's always a great idea to listen to podcasts. And yes. There's lots of, you know, there's lots of great, really great podcasts out there to listen to. And but also you could take like an online class. There's, you know, massive amounts of content out there. Schools like Yale and Oxford and MIT are offering their courses basically free. You can listen to them. You can, you know, download a lot of times their syllabuses, and so, and get the, you know, books on those, but just listening to those, you know, kind of accumulating that information, again, you know, kind of building an inventory to where you'll be able to, you know, make the associations. And when you're looking, you know, sort of, you know, when you're sitting here and you and I are talking, I'm trying to like make a comparison, that is all, you know, content that I can draw off of in order to make that comparison, so I just don't rely on chess all the time. And I think the other thing too, people sometimes miss is like, and this is what we talk about, a sort of creative knowledge to a creative intelligence, is that I find I get a lot of inspiration from like creating unique music playlists and then listening to those playlists and see how they work together and just kind of accumulating that knowledge. And of course, a lot of times you have that playlist, you have the artist, and I'm always interested in the artist behind the music, so I'll go and look them up. And you just find it interesting, you kind of create a lot of knowledge that way too.
Do you have a lot of 50 Cent and JT on your music playlist?
I do not, unfortunately.
Okay, so as you're doing this, right, all these different ways that you're able to gain this knowledge, take notes, okay, both of the specific skills and lessons that you're learning as well as the inevitable connections that your brain starts to make. And when I say take notes, those can be in a lot of different forms, whether it's Evernote, whether it's handwritten on note cards, whether, you know, you use Damien's process of make connections inside of your mind. Whatever take notes means to you, take notes. And we talked about this in the last episode. You know, as you gain these new ideas, the way you turn it into knowledge, useful knowledge, is to make connections between the new information and the old. And these connections a lot of times will hit you during seemingly random times when you're doing something with your body that Damien describes as mindless, walking or mowing or gardening, whatever it may be. Record and remember these connections, whatever strategy works for you. This is the knowledge your audience expects you to be synthesizing.
you know, if you put the info into your brain, your brain's going to do the hard work of connecting it for you. You just need to listen. But it's not just quantitative knowledge that's important. Dates, data, facts, figures. Qualitative knowledge is also important. And Damien, you actually have a warning to offer on this subject, right?
Yeah, of course. So just a little history here. I grew up, you know, my dad, he put a, you know, I grew up with a father who put a huge premium on intelligence. And so, you know, we were always a very bookish family. I was, you know, punished, you know, my form of punishment was sent to my room to read the encyclopedia. The only problem with that is I actually enjoyed that. But, you know, so there was a high, premium put on intelligence. But yet, what we lacked social and emotional intelligence. The Farnworth, you know, the men lacked that social and emotional intelligence. And it, you know, here's a classic story. My grandfather, right? My grandfather's a young man, went into the insurance business, and he's a very abrupt, curt, some would say abusive, you know, sort of verbally abusive. He just spoke his mind, and he was very forthright and stuff like that. And to kind of help him. Guide him as an insurance salesman. They gave him Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence Family. Right. Well, told him to take that book and shove it, and he quit there and bought himself a couple apartments, rehabbed them, and bought a liquor store, and it ended up being very successful. So I mentioned that because, you know, that's kind of where I come from. I'm kind of like, I always put a high premium on intelligence, but I've learned over the years that there has to be an emotional, you know, and social intelligence if you want to communicate and be successful in life. Because here's my warning, right? Everybody should read Daniel Goleman's book, Emotional Intelligence. And the lesson you will learn from that book is that a high IQ or just knowing all sorts of things is not an indicator of future success. But a high EQ or emotional quotient, however, is. Malcolm Gladwell, he also makes this point in his book, Outliers, another book I think everybody needs to read. And he discusses the story of Christopher Langen, who's a man who ended up owning a horse farm in rural Missouri, despite having an IQ of like 195, which Einstein had an IQ of about 150. So it just tells you, you know, it sort of gives you an idea of how smart he was. But then Gladwell compares Langen with Oppenheimer, who is the father of the atomic bomb, and Oppenheimer was way more successful, even though he had a significantly lower IQ. Yeah, and you know, the difference was that Oppenheimer had the support and the cultivation, the practical knowledge, sort of like the social and the emotional, to navigate life's trials and tribulations, whereas Langen did not. And the example that he gives in this book is where Langen is sort of the way he dealt with sort of pressure or rejection was to sort of hide and run away and or to kind of compromise, which, you know, he would just stick to his sort of principles and never force outside of that. But, you know, of course, he has nothing to show for that. That we know this by now, that, like, having that emotional capital, that emotional ability to sort of, you know, swim easily in the social waters. Like, the New York Magazine spoke about two different papers recently, and one of them was by Cameron Anderson at Berkeley. And his colleagues, they published a paper supporting this idea of showing that overconfidence increases one's status. And then there's another paper that had a few more striking findings that said that people who overestimate their skills so grievously yet might not, and you think that, like, there would be some backlash when they're exposed, that's not true. Think of, like, Donald Trump, or say, like, tell me if I get this right, Kanye?
Yeah. Yeah, Kanye West. He's the best rapper alive.
Whatever. Kanye West. Yeah. But, you know,
people, yeah, he's married to Kim Kardashian. So.
Yeah, Kardashian. Right. Okay. So, but these people who, like, are just, you know, Kanye, right? He's what he said. He was like Jesus or the Beatles, and clearly he's not, you know. But it hasn't affected his career really. I mean, it's shown that he still has stayed in people's higher elevations of higher status. And so the point being is comes down to this, is like having that kind of confidence with that knowledge, right? That ability to be able to, and this is what it comes back to what I was talking about earlier, having that sort of self-awareness of who you are, because you can have the knowledge, but not have the ability to kind of, or the confidence to translate that knowledge into any kind of meaningful or sort of controversial association that might stick out, because that's really what it's about. And I mention this because I get asked a lot of questions. One of the questions I get asked, as a freelance writer, how do you set prices? How do you, charge prices? And my answer was always kind of, well, it depends upon the value you bring to the table. But it also depends upon your experience, but it depends upon your confidence too. If you can bring a lot to the table, you usually have a lot of experience. But if you don't have the confidence to ask for that, ask for that higher fee, you're probably going to get underpaid. However, people who have a lot of confidence but don't have the experience can usually get away with that, because people respect people with confidence. So that's what I'm sort of meaning by that sort of, having that intelligence about your self-awareness, knowing who you are, being able to grow in that, and being able to cultivate who you are, so that knowledge is just not just, again, just some kind of items you're kind of sticking into an inventory and cataloging.
Let me ask a question about the subject of emotional intelligence, because I've read something somewhere. I don't remember where it was. I'll try and find it and link it in the show notes. But it was some study talking about how reading fiction specifically, a lot of the books that we've talked about in this podcast series have been nonfiction books. Books that help you, get better at certain elements of business or whatever it is. But they were talking about one of the benefits of reading fiction is because you develop deeper levels of empathy and emotional intelligence. And they posited that the reason for this was that as you're reading a fiction story, you're having to use more of whatever subconscious emotional intelligence you have to read into the words, to understand the relationships between characters, and that helps you develop this emotional intelligence, for lack of a better term. I think they use a different term for it, but it's the same idea. And so on this topic of knowledge creation, we haven't necessarily recommended any fiction books or recommended reading fiction for people who are looking at this topic through the prism of improving their business and moving their business further. But I'm curious, you, Damon, you are a reader, a big-time reader of nonfiction, fiction, everything. And you even grew up a reader, even though you say that you grew up perhaps not having as high a level of emotional intelligence as you wanted to or as you have now. So do you, from your own personal experience, do you buy into those findings? Do you think that there's anything to that? And what benefit would you place on reading nonfiction materials for the audience that will be listening to this podcast from a knowledge curation point of view?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the word you're looking for is empathy. And that's what they're saying, is like it, reading fiction cultivated that empathy. So the sort of feelings for other people, compassion for other people. And I think there's a lot to, of course, I think personally, there's a lot of truth to that. Because really what it amounts to is, sort of a playbook for life situations where you may not always have that opportunity to get encounters. You may not have the experience, right? And that's what it serves for, as a surrogate for experience. That's what novels do, especially ones that, deal with relationships. I'd probably say that, ones that are plot-driven, less so than ones that are sort of character-driven. Not to say that, plot-driven, like, say, your fantasy, because I think of, like, The Lord of the Rings, for example. I recently just read that with my son. And, great storytelling. And there are, some pretty high elements of, kind of relationships and dealing with it and, empathy. But, say reading something by Jane Austen, for example, which I've never read, or something by Dostoevsky, which I have read, you're going to see the sort of psychological dynamics of people and sort of, have a better understanding of human nature. So, yeah, there's definitely a huge benefit to doing that. And kind of like what I like to do, just to help people kind of grasp this, is like I try to choose, like, I try to read one sort of fiction book every month or 2 months, something like that. So, and I'll have like four or five other books I'll be reading at that time that are sort of on certain disciplines. But I kind of look at, and so when I'm reading a certain fiction book, I'll tend to read like a series of books. Like recently I was kind of on a Faulkner kick, so I was reading a lot of his books. And then I sort of switched over to Tolkien, and there's a huge difference there. But there is a lot of benefit. Again, it's storytelling, so you can't go wrong with that either. So,
mm-hmm. So to close, I want to make sure that we leave the listeners with specific actions they can take away. And this conversation here in the fourth episode about curating knowledge has been much more qualitative, and necessarily so, than the other ones. This is more of a bigger picture type conversation. But there are still some specific takeaways, some specific actions you can implement around this. And this is going to be a little bit of a review because we've talked about these in other episodes. But for me, and Damon, if you have any of these at the end, certainly jump in. But two concepts that have really changed how I go about curating knowledge. And I've mentioned them on previous episodes, but I want to mention them again. Number one is how I read. And Damon, I actually have you to thank for this. Posts of yours from CopyBot, like how to read a 291-page book in 2 hours and how to absorb a book in your bloodstream, have really helped me create better habits and not only read more efficiently, but get more out of it too. And being able to read efficiently and ensure that that time is well spent and that you're learning and taking something away from it is so important with how busy that we all are. I mean, it's a challenge to make time for reading, and so you want to make sure when you do that you're really getting something out of it. So I highly recommend those two posts as kind of an introduction to that topic. We'll link to them in the show notes, of course. And then number two is how I keep track of what I'm learning. And as I mentioned on the last episode, I like Ryan Holiday's idea of a commonplace book. I'll link to his post again in the show notes if you missed it last episode. It's a way to merge what you're learning in books and articles and TED Talks and random conversations and just everything that happens to you in life, everywhere else that you gain knowledge, so that you organize it and actually use it. Because it can be a little overwhelming sometimes when we get all these notes, we have all this stuff, and then it comes time to use it, and if there's no process there, you might not get anything out of all this time that you've put into it. And there's another step I may end up taking, and that's taking advantage of a program like Scrivener when I write. I haven't used it yet, so let me offer that caveat right now, but it was strongly recommended by Michael Hyatt recently, and I like the features. It provides a number of ways to organize the information you need for a particular piece you're writing, like digital note cards you can arrange, which we talked about in the last episode, and outlines and more. So I'm going to try it. And I'll be sure to write about it or tweet some thoughts once I have some experience with it. But again, you know, the overall theme of this series has been to understand the why behind curation and the different types, and then to devise a system or process that works for you. So, and because I found my own, I found in my own work that curation only becomes consistent and therefore useful as part of my workflow when it is consistent. And when it's not, or when I fall into bad habits, it falls by the wayside. And when that happens, now I'm not fulfilling my duty to the audience I have and to the audience I'm trying to build, because I'm not bringing that bigger picture, that conceptualization, that higher level of wisdom that they're expecting, and that builds authority. And kind of the step-by-step process that we've gone on in this series on content curation is how you do that. It's how you acquire it. It's how you communicate it to your audience. And it's how you use it to your advantage to build and maintain that audience that helps you build your business.
So I will say that Sonia Simone swears by Scrivener. So there's okay, your...
Well, that's a good enough endorsement for me.
That's right. That's scary. I think he's a convert also.
So. Yeah, okay. Well, that's about two of the best endorsements you can get from CopyBlogger. So if Sonia and Chris like it, then I think we can safely endorse it.
That's right.
And with that, Damien, I have to wipe away a tear as the content curation podcast series comes to a close. It's been fun.
I'm virtually handing you a tissue right now. So.
Thank you. Thank you. And just so everybody knows, we will be going on a summer schedule. The blog is already on the summer schedule. We'll be doing it with the podcast too. So there will actually be no more new episodes of The Lead during July and during August. We'll be back in September. But we are doing this with a purpose. It's not just to kick back, relax, and drink lemonade on Fridays, but we're going to be turning the 11 essential ingredients of a blog post into an ebook and possibly an audiobook. And I'm sure we'll be doing something with this content curation series as well. So this will give us some time to do that, regroup, plan some great new content for it when we do come back in the fall. So if you miss us, just know that we are hard at work continuing to create content for you. And if you do have any topics that you would like for us to cover when we come back from the break, feel free to just shoot us an email, comment on Google+, email me, jared@copyblogger.com. We'd love to get your ideas for topics that you want to hear about. But other than that, Damien, it has been fun. Thank you for your time, and we'll pick this back up in September.
Thank you, everybody, for listening.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, as always, for listening to The Lead. And thank you very much for your attention to this series. When Damien and I first discussed doing this series on content curation, we really weren't sure what the response was going to be, but it has been overwhelming. You all have really seemed to find the content useful. It seems to answer a lot of questions that you had and maybe you were asking and not getting answers to, or just not asking at all. And that has been the most fun part about this series, is it's made us, you know, it made us more motivated with each episode to provide more and more and get to deeper levels, because everybody who listened and who commented was just gobbling it up so much. So we really appreciate your feedback on that. We hope that you enjoyed it and found it as useful as it certainly seemed like you did. Like I mentioned, we are planning on turning it into an ebook, doing some things with this content. So be on the lookout for that. Again, there will be no more new episodes in July and August, but we'll be back in September with new content. In the meantime, if you are finding that you enjoy The Lead, and if you're going to miss us while we're gone, we would appreciate you leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes, or tweeting the links to a friend, emailing it to a family member, and go back through the archives and listen to some of the old episodes if you're not caught up. But we will, we look forward to coming back in September with new content. And again, thank you for listening for this past half year. And we're excited to join you again come the fall.
So I wish I was a slave to an age-old trade. Lord, have mercy on my rough and rough.